Du lytter til Radio 24/7.
Den originale taleradio.
Velkommen til Elektronista med Christiane Vejlø.
What would happen if Ted fucked Burning Man? Det spørgsmål stillede Sid Lee, et kanadisk kreativt bureau, som i øvrigt og ikke helt tilfældigt arbejder tæt sammen med det alternative og ret så syret Cirkus Cirque du Soleil. Ted er en konference, hvor kloge hoveder deler idéer og prøver at gøre verden til et bedre sted. Og Burning Man, det er et syret træf af skæve kunstnere og folk fra hele verden, som dropper deres mobile netværk og flipper ud i den amerikanske ørken i en uges tid. Sid Lee ønskede altså at skabe en konference med lige del kloge ord og skæv kreativitet, og resultatet det blev konceptet C2, som står for Creativity and Commerce. I hjemlandet Canada, der tæller konferencen talere som Kevin Spacey, Chelsea Clinton, James Cameron og vores egen danske arkitektstjerne Bjarke Ingels, som nu i øvrigt skal til at lave Googles nye hovedkvarter. Men det er en anden historie. I den her uge, der rykkede konferencen C2 til Danmark, og jeg var blandt de 80 deltagere. Og C2 er bestemt en anden slags konference, end jeg er vant til at komme til. Den minder ganske rigtig lidt om den danske version af TED, men med et betydeligt større budget og lidt mere velbjerget deltagere fra den øvre del af erhvervslivet. Der er gourmet catering, meningsfuld parkouroptræden, små sjove interaktive øvelser, lækre videoklip og et gennemtænkt soundtrack. C2 er gennemført. Og der er kameraer, der filmer overalt. Mest til intern brug, forlyder det, da jeg spørger, men jeg har altså googlet eventen og set videoer fra tidligere år, så jeg går konstant rundt og tjekker min mundvig for croissant-krummer, mens jeg smiler på den der, jeg har ikke set dig, men jeg synes, den her ting, jeg kigger på lige nu, er enormt interessant måden, hver gang en fotograf zoomer ind. I lokalet der finder man topfolk inden for marketing, innovation og teknologi, og man skal ikke lade sig narre af de pæne jakkesæt og lækre sorte businesskjoler. Deltagerne de er kreative, de tænker ud af boksen, og de er ikke bange for at kaste sig ind i produktudviklingsworkshops med komplet fremmede mennesker. Vi snakker ikke af den her slags workshops, hvor man skal high-five sin nabo og kramme fremmede, mens man hylder sin arbejdsglæde. Vi snakker hardcore innovation. Og på under en time, der har vi i fællesskab skabt en intelligent skosål, som måler, hvor mange skridt man tager. En jakke, som med små boss i skiftevis venstre og højre ærme, viser brugeren, hvilken vej man skal gå. Og selvfølgelig en tællebær. Ikke en teddybær, men en tællebær. En bamse, som muliggør telepati mellem forældre og børn på tværs af afstande. Manden, som gav rummet inspiration til netop den her øvelse, han hedder David Rose. Han underviser og researcher på nørdernes mega MIT, og han har tidligere undervist 5 år på Harvard. Han har fingrene i et utal af teknologivirksomheder og startups, og han er en af de mennesker, som virkelig ved noget om det, som vi kalder Internet of Things, når ting omkring os bliver intelligente. Og David Rose, ham skal vi møde lige om lidt. Mit navn det er Christiane Vejlø, og i dag der bliver programmet delvist på engelsk, fordi jeg ud over David Rose også har en amerikansk og en østrigsk gæst i studiet. Det er et absolut all-star team, bestående af interaction designer Simon Herzog, Alena Percival fra Women Who Code, og så selvfølgelig David Rose. Du lytter til Elektronista på Radio 24/7. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, it's great to be here. Hi.
Thank you.
David Rose, you actually come to Denmark quite a lot. Why is that? I know you love Danish design and that you shop a lot, but apart from that...
How do you know I shop a lot?
Because I saw it in your pictures on your slides yesterday. All the Danish knickknacks in your home.
I've been teaching at a wonderful place called the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute for the last 4 years. And I do a couple of different courses, but probably the most interesting one to me and to the students is one called Enchanted Objects. And it's a workshop that's 2 weeks long. And I collaborate with another maker and designer and magician from London. And so together we come up with how could we invent the future of how people might interact with everything, you know, beyond smartphones, beyond tablets and computers as we know them. So one of the assignments is to take a field trip to IKEA, buy something from IKEA, either lighting or furniture or curtains, a bench, and figure out how to embed technology in that ordinary thing in order to create an enchanted experience. So you might have curtains that you can gesture to, or benches that know your dating profile and get and sort of automatically snuggle you up to other people that you're that you're a fit with. And actually,
so you're sort of like forcing physical contact with the person that you might be.
Well, it's sort of a tangible way in public space to sort of to see whether, you know, there seems to be a match or not a match. You know, so the funny scenario there is you have two people who are already dating or married that sit down next to each other on this bench, and then they're sort of separated by the bench because they're, you know, no longer a fit according to their profiles.
That's the nightmare.
That's right. Or a magic lantern that knows, that listens to what you're reading when you read your child a story, and then creates sound effects and lighting effects that enhance the story that you're reading. So these are the types of things that the students invent. And, you know, it's really inspired by metaphors of magic and sort of the, you know, things that magicians know how to do in, you know, sort of intrinsically in their trade, which is to create dramatic tension, to focus people's attention in ways, and to create this sort of narrative arc with, you know, oftentimes with things that are technologically driven. But, you know, as technologists, I think there's a lot we can learn from the practice of stagecraft and of spectacle to try to make devices that are technology devices easier to use and more magical.
Simon Herzog.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're Austrian, so maybe it's Simon Herzog.
Simon Herzog. Simon
yeah.
Herzog.
You've been a part of this program. You're an interaction designer.
That's right. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about acting with objects like in this way.
Sure. I think what David has been teaching for those 4 years really gets to the core of what interaction design is, which is finding the best way or finding new ways, interesting ways for people to interact with things. So that can be anything from software, that can be objects, physical or otherwise, can be other people in terms of services. So really interaction design to me, and it, you know, definitions differ, but it's really all of the different design disciplines folded into one with a people-centered focus. And that's really what CID, the Institute of Interaction Design, is about. So people come there from all kinds of different backgrounds, from civil engineering and mechanical engineering. I'm from sociology, music and fashion design myself, and, you know, architects, people from all around the world, and bring their expertise and apply it to in a design-driven, people-centered way. And that's exactly what we were doing with David also when he came in and taught us. I'm doing something different now. I'm still involved in the CID network, but I actually manage an incubator there. That's a design-driven, people-centered incubator for people in the greater CID network and the community to actually take those projects, some of the things that David just mentioned, for example, could turn into actual businesses and companies afterwards. So we give them the space and the time and the resources to actually develop that into something more mature and business viable in the end.
We also have Elena Percival here. Elena, you're American and you're based in San Francisco, very close to Silicon Valley. This is like the center of it all where technology happens. Do you see the same trend in California with the products that are being created? We've seen some years where software has been sort of top of mind. It's what people have been working on, apps and everything. But it seems now that we're getting many more physical objects, and that they are, like David and Simon are talking about, that they're enchanted, that they can actually do something more in our lives.
Yeah, there's definitely a theme now around, you know, the Internet of Things has become a word that people are talking about a lot. And so, yeah, this is definitely top of mind in tech right now. But you guys are talking about some of the more exciting things that I've heard about recently.
So then we should get back to you, David, and hear about these four future scenarios that I know that you talk about. They are terminal things, like a future of terminal things, a future of prosthetics, a future of animism, and a future of enchanted objects. I think we've sort of already said that you like the enchanted objects, but let's go through them all.
Right. So I wrote a book called Enchanted Objects that in the first part really describes these four trajectories, you know, four places that technology could be located in relationship to us. And I think the first one is what I call the terminal world. And I'm trying to sort of say that this is not the most preferable future, one where we have these convergence devices, these smartphones and phablets and tablets. They're convenient because they consolidate all the technology into one place in our lives. But I think they offer, I think that they do so at a compromise. You know, most of the apps that are on these things, you'd sort of rather have you'd rather encounter them in your life in a different way. You'd rather have, if you're writing, you'd rather have more screen real estate. If it's a map, you'd rather have it be horizontal. If you're, you know, all these apps are a compromise because they're, because they need to be sort of shoved into this one small form factor that, that can fit into your pocket. And they also seem to monopolize our attention, I think, because they have this call and response interaction paradigm. You know, you do something, it does something back. You do something, it does something back, which really tends to like suck you into this place where it sort of damages human relationships because you're so focused on this one thing.
So you're sort of narrowing your vision down to a single screen.
Exactly, exactly. And I think if you're an interior designer or an architect or a furniture designer, you know that there's a lot more real estate in people's lives in the, for designing. You know, there's walls and their windows and their ceilings and their floors, and all of those places are real estate where we could imbue information or ambient sort of sensors or displays. And so the one future is the terminal world. So another place you could put technology is in and on ourselves. You know, this is sort of the fantasy of Iron Man, you know, like it's a suit that you can put on and it makes you, gives you superpowers. It does everything for you, right? And it's not like Superman or Aquaman where you're born with the ability. You know, this is something that's transferable tech.
But who hasn't dreamed about that costume?
That's right. Right. But I feel like there's a fatal flaw there, which is social isolation. You know, I spent some time with Thad Starner, who's the guy behind Google Glass, and you know, he's just sort of a social pariah. You know, he walks around MIT and he's always wearing like something on his face. And you're just like, Thad, just like talk to me as a normal person. But he always like he's distracted and you don't know whether he's looking at the screen or looking at you. And it really, it's damaging.
So he's sort of the bionic man.
Right. Well, he's been experimenting with what it would mean to be, you know, to have your to have a different view of reality than anybody else around you. You know, wearing earphones around society, you understand that somebody's in a different audio space. And it just means you can't talk to them as easily on the bus or at work. And sometimes that's useful. But imagine when we're all walking around and we're all seeing a different reality. I think that will be, it will really threaten human interaction because we'll all have sort of, there won't be a consensual view of what we all see.
I feel like asking you, Elena, because I know that in California, there has been signs up in cafes or restaurants, like not to wear Google Glass. Have you seen any of that?
I haven't seen that myself, but I do know that there's been a bit of a backlash to this kind of thing. And, you know, it also separates you from society. You've got the tech people that have this, and then, you know, the rest of society says, hey, you know, we're trying to have a coffee here.
And because you can actually film with this Google Glass and you don't know, like you're saying, David, if they're looking at the glass or if they're looking at you or what's actually going on right now. Are they sort of in some parallel universe right now?
Right, right.
And that's why they're called glass holes.
That's right. Right. So one place we can put the technology is in and on ourselves. Another sort of the opposite to that, the converse to that is we could stay as we are as humans and we could outsource the technology to social robots. You know, I sort of think of this as the Downton Abbey fantasy where, you know, you've got like a different agent to drive you, to dress you, to cook for you, to teach you.
Like the butler and the servants.
Yeah,
and,
that's yeah. Right. So, I mean, that's sort of convenient, right? Because then we don't have to change. They can just serve us. And the robotics community, I think, really... you know, this has been a fantasy for a long time is that the solution to human computer interaction is to have our computers be humans or be as human like as possible. So this is, you know, 3CPO, and this is, you know, Metropolis, and this is
Rosie,
the robot. That's right. And I think we know from a lot of experiments that have been done that the more It seems to be a good idea until you start making computers that look like golems from Jewish folklore or like Frankenstein or zombies. You know, things, the closer things get to human likeness, the more they sort of freak us out and threaten our own humanity.
The uncanny valley, right?
The uncanny valley.
Maybe it's a question of fidelity, though. Maybe as you get perfect, then it won't be that bad anymore, maybe then we'll be completely okay with it. Because there is a dip,
right,
and then it goes up again.
When we have perfect replicants, that will solve problem.
This seems like a place where we should start talking Baudrillard or something like that. But I have a quote from Oscar Wilde that I would actually like to read to you and hear what you think about. He says, "The fact is that civilization requires slaves. The Greeks were quite right there. Unless there are slaves to do the ugly, horrible, uninteresting work, culture and contemplation become almost impossible. Human slavery is wrong, insecure, and demoralizing. On mechanical slavery, on the slavery of the machine, the future of the world depends."
Hmm.
That's sort of
Right. I guess I certainly believe that if you're diffusing a bomb or cleaning an oil pipeline or even, you know, getting the leaves out of your gutters on the house, you know, like obviously, like you want tech to perform those dirty drudgery type dangerous jobs. I think that's a little bit different than saying that our interaction with tech should be social robots, because I don't think those things like the iRobot robot that's diffusing the bomb, or the one the what's the one called that you can throw into a dangerous building, you can wear it on your back, you toss it into a dangerous building, it sort of roams around and maps the environment and tries to figure out what's happening inside. That's not trying to interact with other people as a social robot. You know, that's just, that's doing a service, and that's a totally utilitarian and useful service.
But I think machines have already, you know, helped us further by helping us farm. So we're able to, you know, create a lot more food to support the population that you then don't need, you know, people to be doing that.
Absolutely.
But you look at rice, and it's still is needing to be picked by hand. So you still have someone, you know, bending over all day long. And, you know, that might be a job that...
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Right. Also, like, factory automation seems like an incredibly useful thing rather than people.
But I think social robotics are also just inevitable. I mean, it's something that's being moved towards. I mean, that's been done for many years. Like, there's the Taro, which is this Japanese furry little seal creature that was given to people in elderly homes and in nursing homes that was really meant to alleviate loneliness. It's something that, you know, something soft that responds to your touch, that's warm, that actually you can play with like a pet, but without having the demands of a pet. And that simulates emotion, that performs emotion in a way. And I think that's something that's being moved towards a lot. And as these robots perform emotion better and better, and maybe approach some kind of thing that you could really call emotion, I think we might see even the civil rights movement for, you know, AI rights or something within our
lifetimes. I think we have that already. Yeah. We have some kind of movement for the sort of, robotics, the needs of the robot, or sort of taking taking the side of the robot, because they can become so developed. Like, what does it mean? Is anyone defending the robot?
There must be some threshold, you know, animals that have a certain level of intelligence. You
exactly.
know, we don't torture animals. And I'm sure we'll get to that point with robots.
Because again, then you get to, like, if you're torturing a robot that totally looks like a human being, what are you torturing?
Right. Well, I think it seems like a good design choice if you're hoping to solve the problem of you know, loneliness for people that are living independently, to make something that feels furry or that is like a seal or like a cuddly thing or like a gerbil or something, you know, rather than trying to make a human, rather than trying to replicate humanness. You know, I talked to the head of iRobot, and he said, we intentionally didn't make the vacuum cleaner anthropomorphize. Like, we didn't put eyes on it. People do put eyes on it and cats on it and other things on it. But we definitely wanted to make it, like, into just a puck that just performs the, you know, sweeping up the house. And
So we're looking, David, at the fourth theoretical futures that you talk about in your book, Enchanted Objects. We've talked about the terminal things. The terminal world, yeah. And then there's the prosthetics.
Well, prosthetics is this notion that the future number two that we locate technology in and on ourselves, sort of the digital prosthetics, the Google Glass. And so I think, you know, the problem of future number one is it demands so much of our attention. This black glass
labs,
right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem with future number two is social, is that it harms our social interaction, like the wearing of the Google Glass, certainly wearing of Microsoft's, what is it called? HoloLens. Or
That's cool though.
That is exciting. I think it's very cool for gaming if you really want to be in a virtual world, but it's not cool for biking around Copenhagen.
Fair enough.
So then the third future is social robots, and then this fourth future, which I think is the most desirable, is the atomization of little tiny bits of smarts in many, many things and just thousands of things around us. And that has the potential to, you know, simplify the technology around us, and really like and just change how we interact with so many things. And the ability to, you know, embed technology into sports equipment will make us more likely to learn and play sports. And musical instruments like Guitar Hero will make us feel more, hopefully more confidence, more willing to participate in musicianship and, you know, trying a guitar or a piece of piano.
A project about that, actually. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's an accessory to pianos and keyboards. It fits on top of any standard keyboard size, and it shows you with lights essentially which notes on the keyboard are going to sound good together. So you can dial in your major or minor scale, and you'll basically, if you follow the lights, it's guaranteed to sound good. And it's really designed to give people that positive first experience to unlock their creativity, to be able to sit down at a piano and just play, which is something that only comes after 3 or 4 years of actual rigorous training.
That's fantastic.
So yeah. That's one of the things I was doing. So exactly in that spirit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Du lytter til Elektronister på Radio 24/7. Jeg hedder Christiane Vejlø. I dag, der har du måske lagt mærke til, at programmet det foregår rigtig meget på engelsk. Det gør det, fordi at vi har 3 engelsktalende gæster i studiet, og de er simpelthen så vanvittigt interessante, at jeg er sikker på, at du holder ved, selvom vi kører programmet primært på engelsk i dag. Vi taler med David Rose, som kommer fra MIT, hvor han researcher og hvor han arbejder rigtig meget med det, som vi kalder Internet of Things. Han taler om 4 forskellige fremtidsscenarier, altså måder verden kunne udvikle sig på. Han taler om det, han kalder terminale ting, altså skærme. Den verden, vi sådan kender lidt nu, hvor vi sidder og fordyber os ned i vores skærme, men det også tager sådan lidt af vores oplevelse af verden fra os. Han taler om prosthetics, altså proteser, eller det, som man også kunne kalde sådan de her helt store, voldsomme wearable ting, som Google Glass, eller noget, som nærmest gør mennesker sådan lidt til en robot, at det også siger han forstyrrer lidt vores sociale relationer, hvis der vi møder et andet menneske, som simpelthen er pakket ind i teknologi. Så taler han også om den tredje ting, som han kalder animisme, og det er jo, når teknologien bliver antropomorf, altså når den begynder at ligne mennesker. Vi har jo set det i en masse fremtidsscenarier op igennem historien, at robotter simpelthen kommer tættere og tættere på at ligne mennesker. Og det er der en masse eksempler på. Der er også eksemplet på, som Simon Herzog her i studiet påpegede, at der er for eksempel opfundet en sæl, som man bruger til demente og til gamle på plejehjem, simpelthen fordi, at de får en følelse af relation ved at sidde og kæle med den her sådan robotsæl, som har store, søde øjne, og det giver dem simpelthen en forøget livskvalitet. Så det er sådan den animistiske samfund. Og så taler David Rose i sin bog, Enchanted Objects, om Enchanted Objects, altså fortryllede objekter, når teknologien, når de ting, vi ser omkring os i vores hverdag, får bare en lille bitte smule af magi i sig. De behøver ikke at være store, voldsomme tekniske apparater, men det kan være små ting som en paraply, som et bord, som et klaver, som Simon Herzog han lige har talt om, at et klaver, som simpelthen hjælper brugeren til at blive bedre til at spille klaver, ved at indikere på nogle af tangenterne, hvad for nogle toner, der passer rigtig godt sammen. Så vi taler videre om Enchanted Objects. And back to you in English. David, I made a bit of a summary here of what we talked about and also about the enchanted objects. So it would be great to hear from you and from Simon also more examples of what is actually what could an enchanted object be. I think it's great when I heard you talk about this yesterday, you actually made some examples from Lord of the Rings. You mentioned the sword of Frodo's sword. That's like an example of an enchanted object.
It was fun. It was fun in writing the book Enchanted Objects to go back to Hans Christian Andersen and to the Grimm fairy tales and just sort of think, just survey all of these stories that run in our cultural bloodstream about You know, what are these magical things, whether it's a mirror or a purse that replenishes or a horn that summons help from incredible distances, or even the evil examples of enchanted objects like the Sauron's eye that is able to be all seeing and all knowing, or crystal balls that show you the future, or, you know, I mean, there are lots of examples. I'm sure you can think of some from your own childhood.
But I think, you know, it's been said any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. But I think that's not the only way to make enchanted object, right? So you can have something that's so advanced that nobody understands it and it seems like magic. But then there's also things that are just so pleasant and so different in the way you interact with them. And I think that's really where interaction design comes in. And that's the great potential of taking even simple technology and, you know, something like a little vibrating motor or something, putting that into something that suddenly responds to you in a haptic, in a physical way that you can interact with in a new way that you wouldn't expect from a typical device like that.
One of the prototypes from MIT was to put one of these little vibrating motors and accelerometers, which senses how often you move something, into a fork. And the goal was to try to help people who eat very, very quickly and probably eat too much because they eat so quickly before they feel satiated and not hungry anymore. So that if you eat very, very quickly, it introduces like a little bit of shake, a little bit of palsy into your, so that you can't really hit your mouth anymore.
So your hands start shaking.
That's right. I don't think that would, it's not a great idea as a product, but I think it's provocative because people use silverware, you know, consistently more than 3 times a day usually. And if you can embed technology, you know, cheaply into even something as common, you know, as a fork or a toothbrush or these sort of small items that we interact with absolutely every day, then, you know, the sky's the limit for what you could imbue with this sort of tech.
But tell me why you think that there's a difference between this fork that sort of pulsates when you've had enough to eat, if you even yourself haven't figured it out yet. And I know that you also talk about a little robot that sits in front of your fridge with like little cute eyes looking at you, making you feel bad if you're going to open the refrigerator. Right. What's the difference? Isn't it the same goal?
It may be the same goal, but I mean, but the robot that I showed an example of yesterday is really trying to be this sort of other social agent in your life. And it's so much simpler just to take the ordinary things that we all use every day, the, you know, watches and wallets and light bulbs and, you know, all these things that we surround ourselves with, and put a little bit of smarts, a little bit of sensing, or a little bit of feedback into those hundreds of things that we all touch every day.
Do you believe that we are not looking at a future where we will have human-looking or creature-looking robots that will help us in our everyday life?
I don't think we need or want a lot more relationships in our lives. I mean, we already have, like, a lot of interesting people around us. You know, I don't think we need to make robots to satisfy that need for, like, good conversation, right? But I do think that we all need feedback for to help make us healthier or make smarter decisions, or safety, or personal expression, like Simon's example of the piano that helps you sort of gain more confidence more quickly in terms of playing a new instrument. Like, those things can be improved.
There's that film Her. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Yeah. This is Joaquin Phoenix that plays a guy that downloads a new operating system for his computer, and it's voice operated, and the voice is Scarlett Johansson, which doesn't make the movie less good. So the a relationship between him and his operating system develops. They actually fall in love because this is an operating system that improves and grows over time. And by the time that she knows him more, she also develops. Could this happen? Could we have these voice controlled objects?
No.
Simon, what do you think?
Yeah. I think so. I mean, it's, well, I'm a technological optimist, so, you know, I believe in, how quickly progress has been accelerating and in artificial intelligence. So what we're talking about, you know, that's not necessarily an enchanted object, but it's an artificial intelligence, right? And that's been growing so fast, and it's, I think, an unstoppable force that, you know, for better or for worse, will be with us very, very soon at that kind of level, within the next few decades, most likely. in terms of objects, you know, I mean, I agree with you, David. I mean, I think the future where we have things that are a little bit smart, that make us smile, that have some kind of interaction that we have with them that's special, that feels helpful, that feels nice. I think those are the things that have the most promising future, and we don't necessarily need to be building social agents like her from the movie, but I do think it will happen, and I do think we'll have to confront that very soon.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely bring in emotion to it. So like you said, the happy, the smiley face to bring about emotion, because that's going to also lead you to a particular result. So, you know, the fork that shakes, that's not making you, I mean, it will make you maybe feel guilty like you've eaten too much. But also, you know, if you have someone that makes a frowny face when you go to take something out of the fridge, you're going to have that emotional reaction and then maybe be more likely to, hey, not do it.
Do you see, Elena, in California and Silicon Valley and the tech center, do you see all these objects coming out? Because I've really noticed, like, there's an app, but then there's also, like, the physical object that goes with the app.
So I'll just say Zynga's Farmville, they introduced the Sad Cow. And the Sad Cow was tremendous for them. I think they actually ended up trademarking the Sad Cow because it was able to produce a much greater result of people coming back and taking care of the Sad Cow.
So. What do you think of that? Should we have like sad robots around us that will make us feel guilty? Like,
we all have this nurturing drive or nurturing instinct. So to the extent that we can sort of take care of these things. I mean, I where I get excited about the Sad Cow or other things that have a personality associated with them is if you can couple the behavior of an online agent to some behavior that you're doing, like maybe the sadness of the cow or the agent is driven by steps that you've walked or bright light that you've gotten because you're in a dark country.
It's like a gamification type thing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Then your nurturing instincts sort of help make you healthier, or I think there's like pro-social things you can do there. But I think just to go back to the Her is an incredibly provocative movie, and but it makes better cinema than it makes a product today. I mean, one of the smartest companies, Apple, has been working on Siri for, you know, acquired the technology and then has been working to develop it. But it still like just barely functions as web search and directions for me today. And I just feel like we will have voice interfaces for discrete items, like for our Nest thermostat. I'm sure the next version you'll be able to say, like, set the heat to 72 or whatever you want to set it to. Or for alarm clocks, be able to say things. Or for your trash can, be able to reorder things. So I'm sure there will be voice interfaces. But if you have an expectation of constraints, like you can't say anything to your thermometer, you can't say anything to your alarm clock, you can't build up a relationship, you know, an intimate relationship with your trash can. You just don't expect that. And so in some ways, sort of having the world of objects as a base that sort of sets your expectation about how you interact with what things and for what purpose, I think we'll have more successful interactions with the technology.
But if you look at Microsoft, they have a similar program called Cortana that's a little bit more advanced and that actually sort of pairs up different things, like in your calendar, they can see that you're going maybe to the airport and then they look at the traffic on the way to the airport. And we see this move more towards ambient services where the services and the technology will actually expect something on behalf of you and give you some advice. Don't you see that there will be more like the voice services that will do that, or services in general that will pop up before you even ask for them and tell you this is what you need right now?
Yeah, I sort of see that as a world of contextual computing, and to the extent that we can have more sensors in our lives that can reveal our behavior or our goals or our intents to this cloud of services that can sort of collude on our behalf, those services like Cortana will be more useful.
And this is what Google Now is already doing, right? I mean, if you're a good Google customer and you use all of Google's services, Google Now genuinely knows everything it needs about you to be able to tell you, listen, your meeting's in 20 minutes and you need to do this before, and here's another thing.
It just doesn't know your stress level.
Exactly.
But maybe if you wear the Google Watch, it will.
In the future.
Exactly. But what we're talking about, right, is narrow versus general AI.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, I mean, if what Siri is right now and what most of the AI we encounter today, the artificial intelligence, is very narrow. It's good at one particular task because we've programmed it to be good at that. But as we move into the future, as technology advances, we'll get to what HER is, which is a general AI, which is capable of not just scheduling events on your calendar or calling you a cab or booking a table at a restaurant, but actually doing everything and drawing from all these different sources of information. And basically, I mean, of course, you know, it won't make sense if your trash can is a general AI necessarily. Maybe not even if your phone is a general AI, but I think we will have these agents that are capable of anything that a human is capable of and more. And then we'll see what we do with them or what they do with us.
Du lytter til Elektronista på Radio 24/7. Det her, det er et digitalt kulturprogram. Det er et program, der handler om teknologi og alle de dimser, der er omkring os, og hvad de kan gøre for vores liv. I dag, der taler vi rigtig meget om Enchanted Objects. Det gør vi, fordi at vi har forfatteren til bogen Enchanted Objects, nemlig David Rose, i studiet. Og sammen med ham er også interaktionsdesigneren Simon Herzog. Og vi har også Alena Percival, som sidder her. Hun kommer fra Women Who Code og kommer til at snakke meget mere om det lige til sidst i programmet. Men vi taler altså om, at vi har ting omkring os, som kan forskellige ting. Vi har diskuteret lidt om den her film, som hedder Her, der handler om en mand, der bliver forelsket i sit styresystem, om det er et realistisk fremtidsscenarie, at vi som mennesker har de her personlige taleforhold med vores teknologi, om det er den retning, vi tager, eller om vi ikke har brug for flere relationer, som David Rose han siger, men at vi mere har brug for, at teknologien, den ligesom er der, er klar, hjælper os i hverdagen, er bare sådan en lille smule fortryllet. Simon siger, at han er måske endnu mere teknologioptimist, og han tror egentlig nok på, at fremtiden kan have de her intelligente tjenere omkring os. Men spørgsmålet er så, altså, hvor meget de kan hjælpe os, og hvor meget de ved om os. Kan de samle forskellige informationer fra de aktiviteter, vi har? For eksempel Google har jo adgang til vanvittigt meget data, hvis vi bruger alle deres tjenester. Det betyder, at de kan forudse nogle udfordringer, vi kan have. De kan hjælpe os med ting, før vi overhovedet selv ved, hvad det er, vi egentlig har brug for hjælp til. Hvis vi er på vej i lufthavnen, jamen, så kan vi få at vide, at der er trafik på den rute, som vi plejer at tage. Og en hel masse andre ting. Det er det, som man også kalder ambient computing, altså at computere omkring os, de fornemmer, hvad er miljøet, og så hjælper os med at indrette os efter det. David Rose, you also say that pervasive is persuasive. Mm. What do you mean by that?
I invented this product called the Ambient Orb a number of years ago, and it was a single pixel browser, if you will, if sort of a frosted glass, grapefruit-sized object that goes on your bookshelf or on your mantle, and it shifts colors to show you data about the world, like the temperature forecast or the pollen count or the UV index or whether there's enough wind for sailing or how your garden grows or, you know, any other single dimensionalizable data that you could put, you know, that you'd sort of want to glance at. And the surprise for that company was that if you put data in a place where it's really unavoidable, where you glance at it, you know, 40 times, 30 times throughout the day, you're very likely to take action. So if it's measuring blood sugar levels, you're more likely to take care of yourself as a diabetic. If it's showing steps walked, your family's more likely to give you shit to, you know, get out and take a walk. So so the problem with embedding information in apps, if the goal is behavior change, is that it doesn't you don't have the feedback loop, right? You don't go into the app and check the information enough throughout the day in order to have this sort of nudge that you need. So I definitely believe that you want a situation where the sensing is passive, right? Where you don't have to like log your food or, you know, the technology should just be able to sense things about behavior and about lifestyle automatically, either through your photos or through, you know, things that you're doing anyway, opening your pill bottle cap. And then the data about behavior should be something that's unavoidable, you know, something that's presented. I mean, it doesn't need to be like a color shifting light. It could be presented adjacent to your food, next to your plate, or on a wall, or on, you know, how hard it is to open a door handle, or how heavy your phone is. Or, you know, I mean,
maybe you could bring in some of the examples. You talked about the pill glass. How can a pill glass be a part of the Internet of Things? How can that become an enchanted object?
Right. So I worked on my last company was called Vitality, and we worked on an internet connected medication packaging. So the goal is to get, you know, in the US at least, about 50% of us are prescribed something by our doctor, and we take it about half of the time. And it results in about $300 billion of unnecessary hospitalizations.
Because people don't take their pills.
Don't take their meds. That's mm-hmm. right, as prescribed by their doc. So we took that medication comes in these little amber pill vials, and so we just reinvented the cap. So we made it pulse with light, sort of subtly, and then play cute little arpeggios, and then send you a text message if you still haven't taken it, or call your home phone if you don't have text messaging. Every week you could designate a loved one that would sort of see which of the days you did or didn't take your meds. The data could flow, if you choose, to a pharmacy to get auto refills, or to your doc if you have a transplant, in order to get the support of your doctor. So, you know, that sort of incredibly simple sensor, it's just a switch on the cap that knows whether it's been opened, you know, couldn't be simple. It's not going to impress anybody at the table here. But still, just having that simple switch on a, you know, standard medication packaging could kick off this whole set of services that really change people's behavior from taking their meds about 50% of the time to taking their meds over 90% of the time.
So it's also what you call nudging, isn't it? That you sort of nudge people to change behavior.
It's accountability. I mean, it's both social incentive. In the case of your loved one would give you a hard time if you haven't done the right thing for you, as well as sort of facilitating something like refills. But I mean, that's just one example of so many things that are becoming instrumented. Like we talked about forks before, you know, for helping people not eat too quickly. But, you know, just, you know, you've heard of the Nest thermostat that controls your heat. You've heard of the August lock or the Lockatron that helps you let, you know, the plumber into the house or your Airbnb guests. You have Car to Go here in Copenhagen, you know, that helps you, that are sort of cloud connected cars that helps you know where they are and find one that's free. You know, just this, I think it's sort of, irrefutable that there's a coming world of so many connected things, from, you know, plants that know, that tweet at you and so that they don't starve.
And it's so cheap today to put technology into things. I mean, the actual materials required and the knowledge also, that's right, becoming much cheaper. It's so much easier to learn. I mean, and, you know, people at CID, I mean, we mostly come to it without any kind of technical background. And mm-hmm. that's something we learn within a week or so, to make something actually connected and potentially enchanted.
That's incredible, isn't it? You know, like in less than a week, you can take students and, you know, have them using prototyping boards and, you know, sort of creating these compelling examples.
And also, what I think the pill bottle is a great example of is what I mentioned earlier. You don't need to have incredibly advanced technology to make something that's useful and enchanted in a way, really. This is a switch. It's the simplest possible electrical component. And yet it's something that's so magical and so helpful to people that, I mean, that's something that is, if you apply technology in a smart way, it doesn't have to be difficult or complicated.
Det her med, at det faktisk er rigtig nemt at komme i gang med teknologi og komme i gang med at lave produkter og programmere produkter, det er der er en anden gæst i studiet, som ved en hel masse om. Hun hedder Alana Possevel, og hun kommer fra noget, der hedder Women Who Code. Hun er CEO hos Women Who Code. I sidste uge, der var det Social Media Week i København, og det betød, at byen den flød over med events og spændende sessions om sociale medier og teknologi og kommunikation. Og jeg var så heldig at være vært på en session sammen med Alana. Og Women Who Code, det er den her non-profit mentor- og uddannelsesorganisation, som fokuserer på at øge antallet af kvinder i teknologibranchen. Der er 20.000 medlemmer i 49 byer i 15 lande, og Alana sidder her, altså også her i studiet i dag. Og Alana, you work for Women Who Code, and this is an organization that helps women get involved in technology. There's a lot of really high-ranking software engineers and great people involved in this organization. And when you hear David and Simon talk about this technology, that it's, that we are actually at the stage where it's quite easy to to get started with technology. How does that fit with your work with Women Who Code?
Yeah, Women Who Code is an organization dedicated to inspiring women to excel in technology careers. And so hearing this, it's really exciting. You're talking about a lot of innovation, a lot of what's going to happen next. I'm enjoying listening to this. But yeah, it's incredibly accessible. The interesting thing with careers in software engineering is you don't have to have gone through a traditional four-year university to become a software engineer. You can use open source and build on top of that and have already a fairly powerful program, you know, in a very short amount of time. You also don't need incredibly complex technology solutions for, you know, really innovative, really cool ideas. And so we're innovating faster than ever. We need more people going into this because actually going forward, all industries are going to be technology industries. And so career opportunities right now for people with technical skills is growing at a pace that is far outpacing what the market currently has.
Simon, you've studied with interaction design, and
right.
And actually, when Elena and I were talking yesterday, we were talking about we need to have almost a new language about technology. We need to make it more hot. We need to sort of be able to explain how absolutely amazing technology is, and that, you know, we feel so passionate about it. And I cannot understand why people don't think technology is the most amazing thing in the world. And when I listen to you guys talking about what you do, I really feel that that's some of the stuff that I can imagine so many young people thinking, wow, I would love to do that. Right. Do you have equally men and women involved in this?
We do, actually. Yeah, CID is traditionally split. I mean, not we don't have to try to do that. It just actually happens. It self-selects in a way. The people that apply are really about 50-50 men and women. And I think it's so important to get women into those fields more. And they are moving into them more thanks to organizations like yours with Women Who Code. But it's something that's definitely happening. And I think interaction design is maybe a good gateway also. It's not for anybody, really. It's not as intimidating, perhaps, as software engineering or as mechanical or electrical engineering, because it's not purely technical. There's a design, and I mean, obviously, it's a design field that draws upon all this technical knowledge and expertise. And we do just enough of it to be able to build something, to be able to prototype things like the objects we were talking about. And we can actually get those done and then, you know, potentially pass those on to actual engineers who will then turn those into reality, into products and so on. But
I think the opportunity, sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but the opportunity for innovation really is in the sort of intersection between jewelry design and furniture design and lighting design and psychology and social. I mean, the expertise, the sort of multiple intelligences that you need in order to make good interaction for this world of physical computing hasn't really been a discipline. I mean, that's why it's called experience design. Like, what is experience design? Sort of everything.
Right.
But that's sort of the exciting, I mean, to me, that's what's really exciting about, I mean, especially being in Copenhagen, you know, you can think about almost all of the traditional furniture forms that you have today will be imbued with software. Like, I definitely believe, like, I've been prototyping ambient furniture at the Media Lab. So we have a Skype cabinet, you know, cabinetry that embeds connectivity, video conferencing in the cabinetry, right? So you open it up, and so that my little six-year-old can see his grandmother in Wisconsin, you know, sort of at
in the closet, you know,
anytime.
Right? Grandma in the closet.
No, she's actually, it's more like a bookshelf, but anyway. you know, or Google Earth embedded in a coffee table, or you know, Amazon replenishment services embedded in a trash can. You know, all of these, you know, you have VIP, the famous trash can makers here. You know, what, like, it would be a better business model for VIP to take 10% of all of the grocery revenue that you ordered in the house rather than selling you pressed steel for, you know, $100,
right.
You know, just as a one-time thing. And so there's this opportunity for all of these physical product makers to participate in this world of services and software.
So, Elena, a lot of the people in your organization must know a lot of the technology behind of all of this. So we see so many new companies or old companies that are trying to get into this new area. Like you say, David, it's pretty much anything. It's like from fashion to furniture, from anything. How can these old companies or this maybe older way of thinking, how can they learn from Women Who Code or other organizations or just people who work in technology? How can these fields meet?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very important for the large and the traditional organizations to, whether they're acquiring companies or really looking at the way startups are thinking about things. And, you know, you see tremendous innovation, like with Nest, where they took something that just had been unloved and neglected for, you know, since it came about, really, and made something beautiful and interactive. And
a thermostat. It's just maybe the most boring thing in the world has
exactly.
become the sexy object.
It is.
Worth $3.2 billion. Yeah. One thing in terms of how bigger companies get into this, the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute has a program called Industry Projects, where they take a brief, you know, they take a challenge from Maersk or from Novo Nordisk or from, who are some of the other
Lego
partners?
Or Lego. Electrolux. It's essentially design consulting, where right. these corporate clients will come in and hire the students for 1 or 2 weeks or so to do, well, basically to bring ideas and innovation to the company. And usually the clients come knowing that CI&D is a place that's not your typical design consultancy who will just try to solve a problem with, you know, existing ideas and existing with low market risk, low technological risk. It's really something that's, if people want to be inspired for the next 5 to 10 years or so, I think that's a good approach. But we also find, I mean, companies really are rushing to bring technology into their products right now. And I mean, the joke in interaction design is always about, you know, the connected fridge. Nobody's gotten that right. Everybody wants to put a screen on their fridge, but it's not about just putting an iPad and, you know, taking some double-sided tape and sticking that on top of your fridge, and then you've got a connected fridge. But there's really, what I've been sensing in CI&D especially is a bit of self-censorship about putting electronics into just anything. And I think we really want to try to find a good justification for doing that and a responsible way to not just make more electrical waste into, you know, putting it into just any object out there, but to really find a way that makes sense and that actually helps people.
Mm. We are unfortunately running out of time. We could talk for hours about this, but I would like here at the very last minutes to ask all of you just 30 seconds, like how do you see the future within your field developing? What are the ideal situation that will happen within the next 5 years in your field? Elena, if you start.
Yeah, I will just say that, you know, every industry going forward, everything you're interested in going forward is going to be related to technology. And so it's important for us to be having that in the core curriculum in our schools, for everyone to at least have some basic knowledge of technology going forward.
David?
I think it's never been easier than it is today to do prototyping with physical computing. And so I really, I encourage product companies and, you know, almost anybody who has an executive role in a company to either do an industry partnership with a brilliant school or hire consultants to start prototyping sort of what it would mean to start to connect ordinary things with the cloud and what that would mean for business models and for the services that could be enabled through that sort of connection.
Right. And I really see the ubiquity of interaction design becoming more recognized and just people realizing that really anything you've ever interacted with in your life, any piece of software, any physical object has been designed in some way, and that there is somebody who thought about how you will use this object. And I think companies are realizing this more, people are realizing this more, and we really see a lot of people flocking towards this discipline because there's a sense that you can take control of what the world around you is like and that you can really build the world to work for you and to be usable. And that's why I'm very optimistic about the field.
And I know that if people who have listened to this program, they can actually follow you and follow your projects. I know, Elena, you are on Twitter and your name is Elena. So you are quite easy to find there. David, you're also on Twitter.
I'm David Rose.
Yeah. Simon?
Simon Herzog.
Simon Herzog. I'm going to put the names out in our show notes so people can find you and continue to follow your projects. Thank you very much to Elena Percival and to David Rose and to Simon Herzog.
It's been fun. Thank you very much.
Og tak fordi du lyttede med til Elektronista i dag, som i dagens anledning var ret engelsk sproget. Det var tre engelske gæster, og jeg har opsummeret lidt undervejs. Du kan selvfølgelig hoppe ind på Radio 24/7's hjemmeside og lytte til programmet igen, hvis der ligesom var noget, du lige gerne ville fange igen. Du kan også dele et link til dine venner, hvis du kender en, der interesserer sig for interaktionsdesign og nogle af de emner, som vi har talt om i dag. Og så kan du selvfølgelig gå ind og downloade eller streame podcasten i en podcast-app, den som du foretrækker. Det kunne være iTunes-appen, eller det kunne være en app som Pocketcast, som vi har anbefalet flere gange i det her program. Følg programmet her på Twitter, der hedder vi Elektronister Lyd, og hop ind på Facebook og søg på Elektronister, så finder du os. Som end også. Mit navn er Christiane Vejlø, og programmet her, det var produceret af Ninette Birk.